Welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guests today are two of my esteemed colleagues, Carl Schreck and Andrei Soshnikov. Carl, an award-winning investigative journalist who's covered Russia and the former Soviet Union, the rest of the former Soviet Union, for more than 20 years, is the enterprise editor here at RFERL. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you. Great to be here, Steve.
All right. Great to have you. And Andrei is an investigative journalist and web editor for Current Time, the Russian language network run by RFERL in cooperation with Voice of America. Andrei, great to have you on the podcast.
Hello. Good to be here.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Now, the reason these two hard-hitting investigative reporters are my guests is that they were both deeply involved in a fascinating and highly informative five-part investigative report that RFERL wrapped up just last week, focusing on President Vladimir Putin's early years in politics. The investigation unearthed a trove of important details that I'd say might otherwise have been pretty much lost to history. It shed a lot of light on the scandals, secrets, and the scent of corruption that swirled around Putin in the 1990s, and particularly the early 90s, when he was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg and head of a trade office within Mayor Anatoly Sobchak's city government, the External Relations Committee. Now, the title of the investigative series is The Committee Men, and you can read it on RFERL's English language website, rferl.org, and in Russian on the sites of Current Time, that's currenttime.tv, and RFERL's Russian service, which is svoboda.org. Now, we're going to talk about the final installment of this investigation first. Before we do, though, I'll just quote from the overall introduction to the Committee Men series. It says that during his first presidential campaign in 2000, Putin pledged to turn a chaotic country plagued by corruption into a just and orderly state. He promised, quote, a dictatorship of the law. But his own long rule has been marred by allegations of corruption from the start and even before the start. And before he ruled, when he was still in St. Petersburg, years before the longtime Soviet KGB officer became prime minister in 1999 and was handed the presidency by Boris Yeltsin on the last day of that year. But as I said, let's start with the final story in the series. Now, a number of our colleagues contributed to the broader project, which is really an amazing joint effort. But this particular piece was reported and written by Andrei and Carl, and it jumps forward a few years from the others. The brutal, fatal beating that it examines occurred in August 1998, 1 month after Putin became head of the Federal Security Service, the FSB. And the victim of the beating, journalist Anatoly Levin-Utkin, had worked on an article that was published less than 2 weeks before his beating, an article that alleged that Putin's appointment as FSB director was unlawful, and also revealed details about his doings back in St. Petersburg in the early 90s. Andrei and Carl, you guys really broke ground on this, I think. Tell us about the story and how you reported it. Andrei, do you want to start?
Thank you, Steve. First of all, I must say that 1998 was a very good year for Russian journalism. Independent news outlets were flourishing. There were absolutely free TV channels that were covering most of the Russian territory. So lots of clever minds decided that they can profit from delivering honest journalism, deeper analysis and investigations to their audience. And there was a small group of journalists in St. Petersburg that just created their own newspaper called Legal St. Petersburg Today. And despite the scientific headline of the newspaper, from their first issues, they were covering very sensitive topics like corruption and scandals in the banking sector. And in their second issue, they decided to publish a biography of the new head of the FSB, Russian most influential secret service. And it was Vladimir Putin who was just appointed the head of this secret service. And their biography was the first one that was so deep and was published with a very big circulation, 31,000 copies that were delivering free with no price to people and to some companies and government organizations. And Anatoly Levin-Utkin, the hero of our last but not least part of the investigation project, was an editor and journalist for this newspaper. He was not an investigative journalist in a classic sense, but he was participating in collecting information from archives and libraries. He was very aware of how to collect documents and find old newspapers, and he contributed to this article about Vladimir Putin by visiting archives and various libraries. And as you, Steve, said, just a week after this story was published in the late summer of 1998, he was beaten brutally near his home in St. Petersburg, and some documents, cash and briefcase carrying material for the newspaper's next issue were taken from him. And as the NGO, the watchdog for freedom of speech claim by quoting the doctor that tried to save Anatoly Levin-Utkin's life, he, quote unquote, was deliberately beaten with excessive brutality and cruelty, end of quote. And I also must mention that several days before he was beaten, according to the former editor-in-chief of this newspaper, there was a meeting between this editor-in-chief and a person close to Putin discussing the latest issue of this newspaper. And this person, again, according to former editor-in-chief, was asking about the sources, financial sources of the newspapers and the sources for the investigation about Putin. And last but not least, they didn't like the photo they put in the newspaper. So we don't have a direct proof that Putin was involved anyway in this brutal murder. But as you can see, in the later days of Putin in power, several journalists were sent to prison and beaten and killed in Russia. So we definitely can't call Vladimir Putin a friend of freedom of speech.
So it's kind of an early indication of how things were, looking forward, of how things were going to go for journalists. So you're saying, did I get this right, that shortly after this article digging into Putin's past was published, somebody who, according to the editor-in-chief of this newspaper, was close to Putin, expressed interest and came around asking about, you know, where the paper was getting its money and where it was getting its information.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's just turn to Carl. Carl, how did you you know, go about your part in reporting the story, and what does it mean to you?
Well, this was a really interesting story for me, in part because, as you alluded to earlier, a lot of our project dealt in details that seemed to have been long forgotten, and this was an absolutely savage, fatal beating of Anatoly Levin-Utkin. It's essentially been lost to history, even though it was, only a quarter century ago. You know, what struck me at first was how little information there was out there about this case, except for, you know, basically those media watchdog lists of killed journalists. You know, there was, you know, a little two-sentence snapshot of Anatoly Levin-Utkin. But beyond that, there was nothing. We couldn't even find a photograph of him. The only photograph we found was in a library archive of his own newspaper with an obituary and an associate that had a photo of him that he gave to us. So a lot of it was, you know, the work, and Andrei did most of the work, was basically tracking down people close to or associates of Levin-Utkin around the time to try to fill in these massive gaps of, you know, if this had happened today, you know, this would be a, you know, a major story all over the world. And, you know, this guy does not have the name recognition of Anna Politkovskaya, for example. But, you know, we felt his story deserved to be told. And one thing that really struck me as well when we talked about the Putin associate who allegedly came and was asking about the financing is how it really echoes, you know, how Putin has gone after the press, particularly in the last 10 years. You know, essentially where any sort of critical reporting is essentially deemed basically a foreign propaganda plot, you know, spearheaded by foreigners seeking to undermine Russian sovereignty. And, you know, this was the account of the editor-in-chief who talked about this Putin associate. The Putin associate, we reached him and he denied it. Which of course is his prerogative. I would say that the editor-in-chief gave a very detailed account of exactly where they met, what was said. So if the editor-in-chief was indeed fabricating the story, he went to great lengths to provide many minute details about this.
Right, and I think it's the investigations says that, in fact, this meeting took place, according to the editor-in-chief, at a McDonald's in central St. Petersburg. So, you know, some details there. And it does strike me also, just, you know, you mentioned the way Putin has gone after journalists, independent journalists. Obviously, you know, independent journalism and independent media have been a huge target of the clampdown that has really intensified even, you know, since the invasion of Ukraine in February and also over the past couple of years in Russia. You know, but it's something, there were several journalists, you know, were killed in the 90s and the 2000s. I guess this one is perhaps the first, Anatoly Levin-Utkin, you know, who has any kind of link to Putin in that he was reporting on Putin's past when he was killed. Sorry. So let's go on. I really found that article fascinating about Levin-Utkin. You know, I have been covering Russia for 30 years or so, and I don't think I was there at that time, but I don't remember, you know, before you guys, you know, did this investigation, I don't think I had heard of Anatoly Levin-Utkin. So, you know, it's really something that I think you're really bringing to light. But let's talk now about the whole project, the whole series, the Committee Men. It's really a bunch of very interesting, very revealing stories about Putin and those around him at the time. Now, this is going back further than earlier than 1998 to the early 90s when Putin was working in St. Petersburg as the head of this external relations committee. There's Colombian cocaine smuggled into Russia in corned beef cans. That's the focus of one of the stories. There's a fake chemical compound called red mercury that was being touted as having alleged nuclear uses. And there are plenty of bribery scandals and a lot more. And all of it tied together, I guess, by the involvement of Putin's External Relations Committee in the St. Petersburg city government. Carl and Andre, tell us some more about this investigation, what you found, how you found it, and what it says about Putin. And I guess maybe what you found most interesting about it. Carl, maybe you go first this time.
Yeah, so, you know, what I would, you know, what I would say is that the idea with this project was, you know, regarding Putin's work at the External Relations Committee in St. Petersburg, you know, much probably the most incendiary allegations were made by Marina Salier, a local city lawmaker who collected very compelling evidence about shady barter deals that Putin signed off on as the head. But we wanted to kind of get away from that, and you know, that's been pretty well documented. We wanted to talk about some other stories. I guess what really struck me about our findings in this is how little things have really changed. Like with the cocaine story, you see, you know, Putin's close associate, Viktor Chekhisov, a senior security official for many years under Putin, and, you know, one of his oldest confidants, you know, spearheading this investigation of smuggled, massive, a ton of smuggled cocaine. And the cocaine basically just vanishes. There's no accountability. There's really no sense among the officials that there's any need to provide any accountability about what was done with this cocaine, even though they pledged it would be used for medical purposes. And you see that, you know, I think in many of the stories, we have a story about, you know, one of the first known instances of bribery in Putin's committee. And you have, what's interesting is, again, very, very damning evidence against this member of Putin's committee, this employee of the committee. And then you have Putin's committee itself coming out and defending this guy who eventually was arrested and appears to have been convicted as well. It is interesting to look back on these stories and think, you know, just think how unthinkable these things are in today's Russia, that a court would rule against Putin's committee, or you know, that a newspaper would basically an independent newspaper would publish a big expose of Putin. I mean, we saw what happened with RBK, a very fine investigative newspaper that essentially was gutted after running Panama Papers investigations. So, you know, it's like going back to a completely different world when you go and report on these stories, and yet you see so many echoes of, you know, of contemporary Russia under Putin's rule.
Right. That's a very interesting point, kind of this, you know, in a way, Putin's been in power, president or prime minister since 1999, a year after Levin-Utkin's killing. And the very early 90s just seems like such a a different time, but as you're saying, there are a lot of things that have not changed much. Andre, what would you say about this investigation as a whole? What struck you most? How did you go about the reporting, and what do you think it says about Russia?
For this project, we've tried to use true crime genre language and techniques to deliver the story of Vladimir Putin's early days to a much broader audience that usually interested in such stuff, since it's not just a stories about current Russian president. It's just some interesting stories about the past and the people who were involved in some shady schemes. And the only thing that connects all this story is the figure of Vladimir Putin and the place, St. Petersburg, early 1990s, and the time, of course. But in another sense, it's just an interesting true crime stories, and we were working with various sources for this story. For instance, we have the database of all the crimes committed in St. Petersburg in 1990s that you could get, that you can download from Darknet these days easily. And if you just type in Committee for External Relations, you will find out some first keys that for our project and for our investigation. And even if you type Putin's family name or Putin's close associates' family names, you will find some interesting information there. And also we worked with archives, and I was surprised how still freely in Russia, I hope none of the censors listening to this podcast, but how freely you still can get some documents from the archives. For instance, we have this court decision that ruled against Putin in corruption case and scam case. And Putin's committee tried to argue against the judge, but they failed. And we could get this decision officially, easily, from the archive. And I'm wondering how many more stories are covered in this physical archives, in this paper archives in Russia. But I must say, of course, lots of the most interesting documents were lost. And if you work with the catalog for this archive, you will not find stuff like what was the salary of Vladimir Putin and his full schedules for the week and for the day. But still, we could get lots of the stories from this physical archives. And last but not least, the people we've talked to, it's quite dangerous to work with sources in Russia for obvious reasons. Nobody wants to talk to independent journalists, but still we could get some memories from people who were directly involved in all of these schemes. So for me, it's these stories are interesting because they are not only Putin's related or corruption related, there are classic true crime stories, and we could get so many information from various sources, and it's all putting together in this puzzle of the story and atmosphere of St. Petersburg in early 1990s. So if you ever been there, you will smell this sense of what the city looked like, and people who were ruling this city were like.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a great description. I think the series, the investigation, really does give the feel, the scent of what it was like back then. Two other things you said struck me. One, the just the notion, the kind of image of Putin or Putin's committee trying to convince a judge to do something, and the judge standing up to Putin and saying, you know, no. So that's quite a probably something that doesn't happen these days. And also, you know, I think you sort of made it sound, you know, a bit easy, I guess. But it really strikes me that, indeed, you know, it's extremely, I mean, I haven't been in Russia for several years, but even when I was, you know, it was getting harder and harder to, you know, to get information from people, especially people close to power, and to have them speak, you know, speak the truth and speak frankly about things that had happened, you know, in the past even. So, you know, I was very impressed by the way, you know, the level of detail and the way you were able to get real comments from people about the things that were going on. I will mention also, Carl mentioned Marina Salyer, the St. Petersburg lawmaker who led a legislative probe into the committee. And the series does include kind of a sidebar on her and on that probe. But as Carl said, I think, you know, the meat of it is really these kind of newly revealed stories about, you know, about cocaine smuggling, about, you know, about this fraud allegations and strange doings swirling around Putin. So, you know, I think that's really the what's great about this series. Now, we're getting a little bit short on time, but either of you guys can pipe up anytime if you want to say anything more, but I'll turn to questions at this point. And I think there's one question that's come in. I think this is about Anatoly Levin Utkin, who is the journalist who was killed. The question is, was this guy someone that Litvinenko might have spoken to? And that's obviously a reference to Alexander Litvinenko, the former security service officer who was poisoned with polonium-210 in Britain in 2006 and killed that way. And I believe the British inquiry said that, you know, the Russian state was almost certainly behind it. So question is whether Litvinenko, who was by the time of his death, was probing into various suspicions about Putin's rise, whether Litvinenko might have spoken to Levin Utkin. So I'll leave that to Carl or Andre.
As far as I know, there was no connection between Litvinenko and Levin Utkin. And in 1998, Litvinenko was still working for the FSB, so in Moscow. So I don't think he had any interest in talking to the journalist in St. Petersburg.
I see. Okay. Thanks for that, Andre. And looks like we also have a question. Listener named Lockie Grant wants to ask a question on the air. Please go ahead. Lockie Grant. Is your mic on?
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I just tuned into this relatively late, and I found it very, very interesting discussion. So I was wondering if you could post the article or the TV series or whatever it is that is the result of this investigation somewhere so that I can read up on it. Thanks very much.
It's posted on the RFURL website, the English version of the investigation. It's posted under this Twitter space. and also on the website of RFERL, which is RFERL.org. If you'd like, you could also email me at guttermans@rferl.org, and I can send you a link if that's easier.
I believe there's a way to post it in the Nest just at the top of the space somehow, but I'm not quite sure how to do that. Thanks.
Yeah, I think it's posted under the space. Sorry, I'm not. Okay, now it's just been posted by the moderator inside the space, a pinned tweet. And you can email me if you need guttermans@rferl.org. Let's see if we have any more questions for Carl and Andrea. I'll just give it a few more moments in case anyone wants to ask anything more. Okay, don't see any for the moment. So I will. Sorry, now I think I see one from Jim Davis has a question. Are you able to are you able to ask it in the space or?
Yeah. Hello. Thank you.
Great.
Question. And sorry if I get his name wrong, but is it true that Litvinenko he had made some statements that Putin had done some pedophilia? It's a serious question. I read it somewhere. I also read Putin's kleptocracy.
I can try to answer this. It's true that Litvinenko claimed that Putin had some illegal sexual activities in the 1990s, but there was no proof for it. And despite the fact that Litvinenko was very brave in combating the dictatorship, some of this stuff he bring up appeared to be not true, or there was no proof for claims such this. And for many years, Russian government was quite transparent, and everybody knew what kind of things going on. And the main thing that appeared to be true was, as you mentioned, kleptocracy. Enormous corruption of Russian government, but other criminal activities, I don't think we will ever be able to prove this. And I think we must concentrate on stuff that we can prove, not only claims by people who did not provide any evidence for this.
Oh, okay, thank you. Thank you. Great answer.
Okay, I see another question from Lockie Grant. Is that a new question?
Yes, yes, it is. So I was wondering what the contributors' thoughts were regarding the level of everybody should be having trouble saying that word.
Kleptocracy.
Sorry. and how that system may have sort of kind of got out of control in the end and stopped being as effective as it once was, and then that being a contributing factor to Putin invading the Ukraine.
I mean, I can try and field this one. You know, as far as the kleptocracy is concerned, I think what you see from the very beginning, even from the early years that we covered in this investigative project, is, you know, Putin very much used his positions, you know, became kind of a patron for a network of friends and associates, who under his rule became extremely wealthy. And this was, due in large part to access to government contracts, and, you know, these people became fabulously wealthy. And, you know, if there's evidence at least presented in investigations by Alexei Navalny and others that in kind of a quid pro quo, a lot of these associates, you know, allegedly became the holders of, you know, what is essentially Putin's Putin's wealth, even though there's, you know, it's not in his name. So, you know, when we talk about kleptocracy under Putin, it's, you know, it's very much that he has used his position and his influence to enable a, you know, a small group of insiders to become extremely wealthy. And Putin's not necessarily necessarily unique in this. I mean, this was going on in the Yeltsin years as well. But of course, Putin's been in power for two decades now, and you know, there's really no sign that that this trend that has been a hallmark of his entire political life is going to slow down.
Thanks, Carl. I think that's a great overview of the situation, really, with kleptocracy and with Putin's rule. That's a good note. But if anyone else has any questions, we'd be happy to respond.
I was wondering if I could ask a follow-up there, if that's possible.
Yes, go ahead, please.
So you addressed the kleptocracy in the early years of Putin's administration in St. Petersburg and in later years. But with regard to whether or not this type of kleptocratic system might start to disintegrate after a period of time, and if there's been any signs of that you might know of.
Well, I mean, I would just say, I don't know if Carl or Andre wants to address, but I would say, you know, the Western sanctions imposed after the invasion of Ukraine is obviously a test of that system, of Putin's system, and the invasion was apparently a decision that he made, you know, essentially by himself or with only a small group of a handful of people involved. So, you know, anyone on the outside of that is, I guess, you know, having to kind of scramble and think how they want to react. So I think it's a sort of the next year and then the next few years will be, kind of a big test of Putin's, system and the way he keeps, you know, keeps people in line, I guess.
Yeah, I would just add that I think the most difficult part, I think, for the system that Putin himself has created is that it really runs just, you know, it's been created in such a way that he's the only person who can really steer it. And, you know, he's not going to live forever. He's not going to be in power forever. And how the system will manage Putin's exit, whether, you know, by death or by, you know, whether he steps down, you know, I think that's when things could become chaotic and you can see, you know, a very destabilized situation.
All right. Thanks, Carl. And that, you know, the investigation, this took us back to the early 90s, Putin's first days and years in politics, And now that response, you know, takes us into the future. So I think it's a good note to wrap this up. So Andre, Carl, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Steve.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Carl Schreck, enterprise editor here at RFERL, and Andre Sochnikov, investigative journalist and web editor for Current Time. They were among the main creators of a quite in-depth investigative project called The Committee Men about Putin's early years in politics in St. Petersburg as the head of the city's External Relations Committee and all the things that happened at that time. So I do recommend reading this project. The stories are very, very engaging and informative. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus at RFERL. On Friday. Thanks for listening.